Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, we discuss the Guatemala Aid Fund. Founded by a Massachusetts family, it supports in-country programs to better the lives and opportunities for the Guatemalan people. But first, today, a story of loss and renewal and the restorative power of art. Lauren Wolk is an award-winning poet, artist, and novelist, author of the New York Times bestseller and Newbery Honor winner, Wolf Hollow, as well as Beyond the Bright Sea and Echo Mountain. Her latest book is Candle Island. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks, Mindy. It's great to be here.
Always nice to see you. Could you read just the prologue to get us started?
Sure. Six mysteries waited for me on Candle Island. One involved a bird. The second, a hidden room. A song, the third. A poet, the fourth. A cat, fifth. A fire, sixth. Each of them exciting in its own way, but none more interesting than the mystery I took there with me.
There's lots of secrets, lots of mystery, and Candle Island is a very interesting place, so I want to know where this inspiration for Candle Island came from.
Yes, because I always start with place. I can't begin a book if I don't have a place I know well that resonates with me in a sensory way, in an emotional way. So I've spent a fair bit of time in Maine with the Island Readers and Writers Foundation, which brings authors and illustrators to these tiny rural schools. Sometimes they're on islands like several, Final Haven, North Haven, and sometimes they're inland in the woods, where I was most recently. They're very small. There might be a dozen kids at these schools from K to 12. There were 12 kids in the last school I visited from K to 7. And so they're very small, and they don't get author visits. And many of these kids have never owned a book. Their families have never owned books. Very poor schools. And so this foundation sends people like me into the schools to talk to the kids about reading and writing, to share my books and my love of reading. And it's really contagious. The kids respond beautifully. So these islands that I've been visiting, I love islands to begin with. And these and the people there just completely inspired me. So when it came time to write a new book, I found myself returning to those islands in my memories and my imagination. So I invented one very much like the ones I visited.
Yeah. And Candle Island in your book, population in the winter, 315, summer, 986.
Yeah. Sounds a little familiar.
Bigger numbers, but yeah, very familiar. All right. So Lucretia Sanderson and her mother, Eliza, come to this small island in part to escape the grief of losing Lucretia's father in a car accident. So tell us a little bit more about these main characters.
Well, you know, it's funny. I always start with a 12-year-old girl. People ask me, why do you always write about girls? And I say it's because I have two sons in my real life, so this way I get to have daughters. And they ask me, are these girls like you? And the answer is always the same, a little bit, sometimes in some cases more than others. They're an amalgamation of me and other girls, women, and people I've known, and a lot of imagination mixed in. So they are authentically individual, unique characters as well. Lucretia is sort of an embodiment of my love of the arts and of the time I've spent in the arts, the visual arts, the literary arts, the performing arts. For so long, I am steeped in creativity, my own and that of those around me. The Cape is just such a creative community. And so when I sat down to write this book and this character came to mind, she was really an embodiment of that part of my life, the things I love so much that I think are so critically important to our society and our world. And so she's a walking, talking representation of that. And then because of the loss she and her mother have suffered and their desire to retreat, for that reason, but others as well, to this little island, I also think she's a reflection of what many kids deal with in their lives. Mm-hmm. Heavy issues, a lot of confusion. They're perplexed by things that come at them out of left field and change them forever. They struggle to figure out how to cope with things like grief. And so although I don't intentionally set out to give them an example, I hope I do.
Yeah.
I hope these characters are an example of how to cope with that.
All you just said, I was about to say, the main character is a 12-year-old girl, but this is not a girl book, right? I mean, this is a book that resonates with both boys and girls.
So I understand from talking to boys, yes. And you know, it depends. Everyone has a different taste in literature, but it's definitely not a girl book.
Yeah. All right, the name, Lucretia, kind of an unusual name. Where'd you get that?
you know, it just came out of nowhere. I like old-fashioned, unusual names. In this case, I can't remember which came first, the chicken or the egg. But Lucretia Mott from Nantucket, the abolitionist, the Quaker, is such an inspiring figure. And honestly, I think I came up with Lucretia and then looked for people who had been named Lucretia. And the roots. I always want to know the roots of the names, their original meanings in whatever, Latin or Greek. Yeah. And I loved that there was this Lucretia Mott character who represents, no spoilers, but there are things that happen in the book that are very much, that inspire Lucretia and others to stand up for what they believe in.
Right.
Just as Lucretia Mott did.
Oh, and this is such a good time to send that message.
Oh, boy. Well, unfortunately, it's never a bad time to send that message because we need it all the time. But you're right. Now, it really needs to.
So there, and Lucretia and Eliza are not the only ones experiencing grief in this story. There's different kinds of grief going on in this.
Lots of different kinds. There's a lot of darkness in my books, but I like to think there's a lot of light as well, and I love the interplay between the two, the contrast.
Yeah, I want to say that because when we're talking about it's a story about grief, this isn't a downer. You don't read this book and feel sad at all. The grief, it brings you to that light, right, and that hope, and it's not. You say dark moments, and maybe there are some dark, but I didn't come away with that feeling at all.
I would hope not. I mean, the world is filled with darkness, and it's filled with light, and some of that light's inside us, and some of that comes from external sources, and this book is really about both kinds of light.
Right. So there's another character, Murdoch. Murdoch and Lucretia form a kind of reluctant friendship. Mm. There's tension, but they can't escape the fact that they share similar feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is more to unite them than what divides them. But you know, kids and people of all ages react differently to grief, to challenges. And Murdoch and Lucretia have different ways of reacting to the hardships in their lives, but they also have common ground. And once they discover that, their bond is strong.
Yeah, we're not going to give away, as you say, we're not going to do any spoilers here, but it was interesting because one of the similarities that they have when you look at Murdoch's background, and of course, you know, Lucretia's new to this island, and I thought, oh my gosh, it adds to that tension, right? Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to watch how that tension develops in this friendship.
Yeah, and I often think the best friendships start off with a little bit of this sort of posturing, gesturing, figuring out where they stand. Maybe there's an alpha and a beta involved. Mm-hmm. Differences are the spice of relationships. And once you discover that, you know, you can become fast friends with someone you didn't at first think you had much in common with.
And I think, I'm not giving anything away here, we'll talk a little about Murdoch. She's kind of gives this sort of toughness to her exterior.
Yes, she's got a hard shell.
A hard shell covering up a lot of the grief and everything else that's going on inside her.
And that grief, and she's angry too.
Yeah, angry,
because of her losses, but also because she lives on an island that is, let's face it, kind of invaded every summer by lots of people from away who don't necessarily treat the islanders with respect.
Wow.
Imagine that.
I was going to say, because it's also the story of the tensions played on just about every island that hosts a summer or tourist population, that friction between the visitors and the year-rounders.
Yeah, the need for them, the financial need, the dependence on tourist dollars. But it's too bad that comes along with a lot of entitlement and disrespect.
Yeah.
Not from everyone.
Right.
I was a summer person once, and I absolutely did not act that way. No one in my family did. But I've seen it too often, and now I feel it myself as someone who's lived here for decades.
So talk about writing about that in this story. Were you drawing on what's happening here on our own islands or islands everywhere? Where did all that come from?
Yep. My own. All of my books are a mixture of fact and fiction, truth and fiction. What I've experienced and what I've witnessed elsewhere, and in a much broader sense. So there seems to be this unnecessary eternal conflict between the haves and the have-nots, or in this case, it's people who have very different things. Mm-hmm. You know, these islanders have a lot of richness in their lives, but they respect it, and I'm not sure the visitors do.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about their arrival. Eliza and Lucretia arrive, and they've bought this house, sight unseen, right, if I recall?
Yeah, fully furnished.
So tell us a little bit about where they arrive at.
They arrive, they find their way to this little farm they've bought as this refuge from the lives they lived before. And it has a barn. They have a horse with them. They brought a horse along. And this little farm has a barn and a pasture and a house fully furnished, which is both a blessing and a curse because it was left as if the people before them just disappeared, went up in smoke. And they feel intruders in their own new home and on this island where they don't feel welcome. And so they eventually have to find a way to feather their nest with their own feathers and make a place for themselves in this world and find people who accept them for who they are. It's a pretty tall order for this mm-hmm. kid who's got a lot of baggage already, but she is brave.
Yeah. She's 12 and she's in this, think about that when you're 12 and you're sort of thinking, you know, who am I? What's my role in this world? And she doesn't have the peers yet the friends to really kind of play off of, like, you know, how are you feeling? So she's really a bit of a loner.
She's very much a loner. Yeah. And I was, you know, I'm an introvert who acts like an extrovert. So I've always had lots of friends, but I've always been sort of wearing masks and different hats and things and trying to fit in. And she's a little bit like that. But even before she moved to the island, she was a loner because of the secret she's carrying with her.
Yeah.
And which is so important to her. What she knows about herself that others don't know is at the center of who she is and how she feels about herself.
And now the book is, I mean, you haven't had a lot of response yet to this, but how do students, when you go to the schools, how do they react to the different characters in your books? Do they say, oh, that's me?
Well, lots of times, yes. And as we were saying before, boys and girls both respond to a character, in this case, female, in all the cases of my books, female, who is courageous and resilient and, you know, the role model for them. But it's funny how I hear from some adults that they think Lucretia and some of my other protagonists are too mature, unrealistically mature. Well, you know, I spend a lot of time with kids. There are a lot of very mature 12-year-olds mm-hmm. out there. All kids are smarter than we give them credit for.
Absolutely.
Wiser, too, which is something different. Braver, more resilient, and far more aware of the world than we think they are.
Yeah.
And so to say that a girl who is strong and self-reliant is unrealistic at the age of 12, I remember being 12.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what that was like. Kids are tough.
Yeah.
And smart and brave. So I like to write about them.
Yeah. So art plays a big role. And I wondered what the process of writing that was like for you, because you're an artist and Lucretia and her mother have different styles. So talk about bringing that to this story when you yourself, as an artist, how did you decide on who, you know, these different styles and how you're going to write about that?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure how to answer it because I'm a pantser. I write without a map. I write without really knowing what's going to happen or even how my characters are going to reveal themselves. Meeting my characters, for me, as I write, is like meeting a person on the street. I get to know them a little bit at a time. So when I learned who Lucretia was and what she loved and what she did with her life, I was surprised by some things, including her choices about how to make art, which are different from her mother's and from other artists everywhere. She is, in that way, very mature as well. She mm-hmm. works with oil paints, which I've never been brave enough to use. But I know a lot of oil painters who can't work with anything else because right. oil is a medium that allows them to take their time and to make mistakes and fix them more easily. And she is a very mature artist with a vision and with a real faith in herself, which is hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
I have an immense case of imposter syndrome. I am constantly apologizing for calling myself an artist because I am primarily a writer, which is a form of artist too. But I know so many fantastic artists on the Cape and elsewhere that I kind of cringe when people call me an artist because I haven't paid my dues. I haven't taken the risks they've taken. I haven't been to school for art. I haven't done a lot of things that quote-unquote real artists do. But I love making art, and I wanted her to love that too. I wanted mm-hmm. it to be a part of her life that gave her a great deal of satisfaction, as my practice gives me.
Mm. All right, so there are secrets, and one that we will give away is that she finds a baby bird that will surely die, a bird she should not have in her possession, but she just can't help herself become attached. And that's true. We're not supposed to take wildlife home, right?
No, we're not.
So where? How did this bird come into the story? I know you say you sort of meet your characters. Did this bird just sort of drop out of the sky as well?
So to speak? Yes, figuratively and literally. She finds this baby, Osprey. And the kind of girl she is, you know, she revealed herself to me in what she did with that bird. What would you do if you found a baby osprey, not dead, but dying on the shore there among the eel grass, croaking at her? She picks him up. She takes him home just like I would, as I have taken many birds home. And I learned a lot in the process of doing that because many of those creatures did die. Even the ones I took to Cape Wildlife or wherever, and they got the best care, they just could not survive what had happened to them. But she is determined, especially considering the loss in her life, she's determined to save this one.
Yeah. There's a scene in the book where Lucretia learns you can hum a periwinkle out of its shell. Fact or fiction?
Fact.
I was like, I read that one, like, can you really do that?
The things I learned doing research, it's absolutely incredible. In fact, I'm writing a book right now that's pretty much the fruits of that labor, just the amazing things we can find. And I lament how much time we spend on devices looking at screens. But boy, oh boy, the internet sure does reveal things that I probably wouldn't have found out about otherwise. And I'm skeptical sometimes. But this one, I not only learned about online, but then I questioned people.
Did you try it?
No, I haven't tried it yet, but I'm going to. Actually, yeah. When it's a little warmer, I'm going to go down and find some periwinkles and try it. But no, I've talked to people who said, oh, yeah, you can do that. Yeah. So I have to believe it's true.
Who knew? There's another mystery, and we want to, but she hears this beautiful voice, this singing, and boy, that intrigues her and sends her on some adventures.
Yeah, music is a very important part of this book too. First, when she hears the seals singing in the fog and on the ledges at low tide, which I have heard many times when I'm in Maine, and it is the most mesmerizing sound. It's ghostly and wonderful and mysterious and incredible. But then she does hear this human voice, and she doesn't know where it's coming from, but it is singing opera.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you. Boy, I was a fan of opera before, but I am really a fan now because I spent a lot of time listening to opera as I wrote this book. And it's just, it brought me to tears every time.
And
every
unexpected, time. Right? To hear this young voice singing opera.
Yeah.
And so there's a story there. Why opera, right? So there's, like I say, all kinds of secrets and mysteries to unfold in this story. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the restorative power of art, because that's a big theme in this book.
I've never been more convinced of it than I am right now. Because I and many, many, many people I know and don't know in the world are suffering from a lot of stress, fear, anxiety, frustration, anger, sorrow, you name it, we have it. And making art is my antidote to all that poison. I think it's also a form of resistance, a form of declaration that we will be who we are. We will insist on our individuality and our creativity. And in this book, which is not at all political, three people who are carrying heavy loads find in their art solace, sometimes escape, reassurance that they are still whole, that they still have a lot to give despite what's been taken from them. Art is medicine. It is roof and remedy. It is sustenance. Mm-hmm. It's nutrition. And if you're an artist, if you have, and I think all kids are born with the seeds of artists inside them, if you let those seeds grow, if you nurture them, if you harvest what they give you, I am 100% convinced you'll lead a more fulfilling, balanced life.
Yeah. Transports you, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Back in time to another time to, and you said to escape. A lot of people are using that, especially music right now, to escape.
Right. Both making art and being an audience for art, both are restorative and powerful. And so our arts institutions on the Cape, they're like hospitals. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk into them, whether you're going for a concert or to see an exhibit or hear a reading, or our libraries are hospitals. All of these institutions have the power to heal us, and they deserve all our support.
Yeah. So going back to the characters, you know, sort of you're learning about them as you meet somebody in the street, Do you have sort of a theme? I mean, you have an idea of where the story is going to go, and then you kind of fill in the characters you go. How do you outline your story? Or you just go, I'm going to Candle Island, let's see what happens.
That's it. I don't outline anything, yeah. I don't have a clue what's going to happen beyond what setting tells me, because I am very, very anchored in the setting. And the setting's like a character, too. And it often determines a lot about plot. And so I just start in that place. And I don't start writing until I have a character in my head. She appears. Mm-hmm. She doesn't necessarily even have a name yet. I don't know who she is or what she's going to end up doing or thinking or feeling. But she's there. And I spy on her in my imagination. I listen to her. I watch her go through her days. And then when she inspires a question in me, a what-if question, what if she does this or what if she does that, I begin to write. And one sentence, which I always come up with in the shower, that first sentence leads to a second sentence, which leads to a third, and pretty soon I am following her into her life. It's like reading the book as I write it. So I get to sense the adventure. I get to laugh when she laughs and cry when she cries. I get to be surprised. It's a wonderful way to write. It's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's also a little scary. You can make a wrong turn, drive off a cliff. If you're not driving with a map, you can end up lost.
But you always can go back and,
yes, you can.
And edit or change.
Yeah, you turn around and go back and find your way.
Do you write every day?
I do, not always a book. Right now I'm between books. I have two more waiting their turn after this one and two picture books coming out. And I write poetry, but right now I'm making film with the artist Jackie Reeves.
Oh, wow.
She is an animator, an animator who has been working with her own art to create animations. And in December she sent one to me and said, would you like to write a poem, or do you have a poem that might go with this? It was the first one she'd ever done. It was a minute long. It was just her scribbles and, I mean, great scribbles. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yes, I need something like this right now. And this was back in December when things were comparatively good in the world. And so I just sat down and wrote very extemporaneously, just like I write my novels, but even more so, seat of the pants stuff. I just scrawled out this thing. And I know a little bit about making videos, so I opened up my very rudimentary software. And I imported her images, and I added my words, and I added some music I had found, and I sent it back to her, and that was the beginning of a new project that we're now submitting to film festivals. And I don't remember your question that got me talking about this, but art in all its forms.
Yeah.
Oh, am I writing right now? Yeah. Yes, yeah. I'm writing. We call them ink lines, and I'm writing. Whenever she sends me one, I drop everything. I could be in the shower, and I'm out of the shower, down the stairs, right to my computer, and I start to work on it.
So people ask you why you write about girls, and you said because you have boys. Do you ever think maybe you might have a good handle on boys' perspective, having boys? Have you thought about that?
I have, and I think a boy book is coming, although, as we said, these are not boy or girl books,
right,
but a male protagonist. I did write a book, well, Beyond the Bright Sea,
right,
which takes place on Cutty Hunk. The first 20 pages were, it's first person, I'm writing. I shared the first 20 pages with some friends, and they said, is Crow a boy or a girl? Mm-hmm. And I said, didn't I say? And they said, no. And I said, huh. Well, I'm not going to tell you. And I wrote the whole book without any revealing pronouns. And then in the end, that seemed gimmicky to me. So I made Crow a girl. But I was thinking of that character in both ways as I was writing. Could have been either.
Really, especially at that age, right?
Right.
Yeah. So what about that? Your books are marketed towards sort of middle grade, young reader. I should say young readers. Middle grade, yeah. But really, when I read your books, I don't think of that at all. It does not seem to me like this is, you know, a book aimed at, you know, middle schoolers.
It isn't.
It isn't,
it
right?
isn't. And that's why, you know, first I wrote Wolf Hollow. It was my first book for young readers, but I wrote it for adults.
Yeah.
And then my agent and the editor who picked it up said, yeah, this is perfect for middle grade. It's a coming of age story, and we need good books for middle grade, powerful female protagonists and all that. So I said, terrific, that's wonderful. But it did not change how I write. I write for a reader.
Yeah.
And if my protagonist is 12 years old and it's a coming of age story, tell me you don't remember what it was like to be a kid.
You don't remember
your own coming of age story.
No, when I read your books, and again, it kind of brings you back to that time in your life.
Right. And because these are historical fiction, some to a greater extent than others, a lot of older people remember that time in their lives. all the way back to the Great Depression, mm-hmm. in the case of Echo Mountain, and those times resonate with them. So I have a very wide audience, and when Wolf Hollow came out and they were going to say 10 to 12 or whatever the age was for the readers, target readers, I said, can we just say 10 and up, please? And they said, sure.
Yeah.
10 and up. So that's what all my books say now.
Yeah. Well, it was a wonderful read. I really, as usual, really enjoyed it. Candle Island, we'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Lauren Wolk, always great to see you.
Always great to be here, Mindy. Thank you so much.
Coming up after a break, we talk with Falmouth resident Bethany Eisenberg about founding the Guatemala Aid Fund and the ways the fund supports Guatemalan-run programs.